The first ever criminal trial of a former president begins this week. I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, and this week, legal expert Ricky Kleeman joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about jury selection, the latest trial developments, and legal strategy.
From the defense point of view, for Donald Trump to be signing checks for Michael Cohen, it would have been something usual because Michael Cohen was working for the Trumps.
The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
So you confirmed your release. It came on Tuesday. I think you made the request. Well, you've been making the request for the last week or two. You do an interview with Submission Radio. And if I'm not mistaken, one day later, your letter shows up.
Yeah.
Quite a timeline. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, you know, it's just nice that it's been resolved so quickly. I think sometimes the best thing to do is to speak out publicly, and it just kind of brings attention to a situation. But, you know, I mean, the thing is the UFC have got so many things going on. Like, it's easy for them to just kind of tune me out and just kind of forget I'm there in the background asking for my release. And that's just kind of what it felt like. It's felt like that, you know, since my job with the UFC has come to an end, to like to get a hold of anybody and get any kind of response is proving very challenging.
So I saw Diego's release letter about a week ago. So congratulations on an incredible career that has spanned over 16 years and 32 bouts with the UFC. Your dedication to the sport of mixed martial arts and the organization is greatly appreciated. As one of the early stars of MMA, you helped shape the sport into what it is today. We wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors, and thank you for all the amazing years and battles you have given us. Did you say anything like that?
No, absolutely not.
What did yours say?
Not a great deal, to be honest. Where's my laptop? Let me grab my laptop, and I'll tell you. I mean, mine wasn't even interesting enough to properly read. I just kind of scan read it and forwarded it to my manager. I was more surprised that I got it so quickly, more than anything. Per your conversation with Sean Shelby, it's our understanding you've requested to be released from your promotional ancillary rights agreement with Zuffa LLC. Fully executed on July 5th, 2012. So that's when I would have signed my last contract.
July 12th, what year?
sorry, July 5th, 2012.
Wow, 2012.
Yeah. Oh, no, there was a nice paragraph towards the end. Well, I didn't read it fully. with your accomplishments both in and out of the octagon, you have contributed to shaping the sport of mixed martial arts. It's what it is today. While also being a global ambassador for the sport, we wish you nothing but the best of luck and much success going forward with all your future endeavors. And thank you for your dedication to the sport of mixed martial arts and the UFC.
Reading that, how do you feel about that?
Kind of weird, to be honest. I mean, I'd always got this perception that, you know, my career within mixed martial arts would come to an end, and it would kind of end with the UFC. You know, I never intended on fighting past a UFC contract. You know, when I was on that four fight losing streak, and I was considering stepping away, I wasn't thinking of going anywhere else. I was thinking of going and studying philosophy at university, a complete different directional change. So I always kind of felt like my career, as far as professional mixed martial arts, would start and finish with the UFC. But then admittedly, I also didn't expect it to continue on so long after me being a fighter. I mean, I'd not really considered the idea of me being an analyst or commentator. So no, I'm very thankful for that time and that opportunity. But it's weird because now I'm still very much in professional mixed martial arts and do want to be. And, you know, I love commentating and analyzing and training fighters and stuff. But now I'm like right on the outside of the UFC for the first time in, well, I mean, forever. Before I was unknown to the UFC, and then I was under UFC contract from 2008. And now I'm just kind of not a part of it at all. And like, you know, with efforts to, you know, properly exclude me in every way possible, which feels really odd as well. Because yeah. I don't feel like any of it's warranted.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, you've spoke at length about the circumstances around it. Do you feel like it was a clean break given your relationship with BT Sport? Do you consider yourself detached now?
No, not really. I mean, I'm still covering UFC events, and you know, we're doing like Fight Companion type shows now and stuff. So I still love the UFC. I still watch most events. I'm not working alongside the UFC anymore, so I'm not up watching the events live every Saturday night, Sunday morning like I was before, and I treat it a bit more like a fan now, I suppose. But I'm still producing content around it. And my relationship with BT is a weird one, because you know, when the disagreement happened between myself and the UFC employee, BT were there. You know, my colleagues were there with me. And they weren't, as far as I understand, you know, I've spoken to them, and they have not been spoken to about what happened. So I don't know, it's just the whole thing's just kind of weird. You know, I've still got a good relationship with BT, you know, Adam and Nick, the Fight Disciples, still got a good relationship with them. I just don't work with them anymore. But, you know, the clampdown on BT came from UFC's side. It was basically, I think, the UFC saying that they wouldn't credential me and allow me in the building, not even to work for BT. But then at the same time, you know, the press release that was released that spoke for BT did not come from BT. You know, BT never intended on stopping working with me. So it was almost like it was, the news was released to kind of pressure BT into following suit and shutting me out as well. But then after that, you know, it was, you know, a couple of my sponsors, they went after a couple of those. And, you know, just my Raptors were denied credentials for events, even though they've been doing great work. Just a lot of vindictive stuff that wasn't really necessary, you know, especially with no kind of clarity of actually what's been said about me. And because I know what happened, I feel like a lie's been told about me. And that's the bit that's frustrating. You know, to be continuing on outside of the UFC and to be finding my own ways, it's quite refreshing. I'm enjoying the uncharted waters, to be honest. But It still burns, the fact that I've got this awkwardness with the UFC that I don't feel like is necessary.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to ask, being the troublemaker that I am, pot stirrer, you know, whatever you want to call it, do you feel any more comfortable with talking about the exact circumstances this conversation over this opportunity withheld?
I mean, I can tell you the details about it. I won't mention the individual's name, but, you know, not for any other reason other than out of respect for the person, but the head of PR in the UK, and I've worked with them for a number of years, you know, from when I was signed as a fighter all the way through to my being an ambassador. And we've never had I've never felt like we've had a bad relationship, but I've also never approached this job as it was a job. I've always approached it like this is my life and I love it. So it was, you know, sometimes my frustrations would be people were kind of dragging their feet and doing, you know, the necessary work. And this was a person I'd complained about before, because I felt like opportunities would be a miss, not only for myself, but for other fighters in the region. You know, young fighters that the media are trying to get a hold of, but the UFC office in the UK is not connecting them. And all these opportunities that would be a miss that were provided for me when I was a fighter, it wasn't like things had always been like that. Things had gotten considerably worse. You know, when I signed in 2008, I had interviews every week. I was busy. I was talking to everybody that was there. Now these guys are not hardly getting any media attention at all. And the disconnect is, you know, the PR team in the office. And that was my frustration, which I'd mentioned a few times. But it seemed to me like that had, perhaps my complaints had not gotten further up the chain. In fact, had actually gotten back to the person that I maybe complained about, because their mood towards me had changed. And, you know, I think the Herb Dean situation didn't help either. But obviously the UFC couldn't terminate my contract after that, because it would look really bad, you know, firing a commentator after standing up for fighter safety. So I think that was kind of a nail in the coffin, to be honest, because of how much control they need to have over those live events. You know, they don't want me. I'm a bit of a loose cannon. And something else that I said, which may have, you know, led to this situation was, you know, when I spoke to the UFC after the Herb Dean circumstance, I said, know, please don't forget I'll work for mixed martial arts before I work for the UFC. And I think that kind of burned a little bit in their minds, because, you know, when you work for the UFC, they want you to be UFC through and through, you know. And I'm a grassroots fighter, and I've got you know, fighters that are around me all the time, people that have come through the sport and have had the same struggles, and, you know, are dealing with issues now that are, you know, that prolong, you know, in mixed martial artists' careers. So yeah, I think I was a little bit too unpredictable in that seat, perhaps. And I think after that moment, you know, there was possibly waiting for an opportunity to kind of push me to one side. And then, you know, after that moment, after that incident, I actually signed a new contract and came out to the next fight island. But then all of my media obligations, you know, most of the first questions were the situation with Herb Dean. And, you know, and again, I was speaking my case and you know, reinforcing my perspective on the circumstance. And that also, I don't think, was looked down upon very well, because then the following fight island, I was taking off all media responsibilities. You know, so I mean, I think it's a combination of a few things. And I think the situation in the last fight island, I gave them the opportunity to get rid of me because of, you know, the Herb Dean thing and a couple of other things.
Sure. What do you make of the shift in attention, or the shift away from UK and European fighters over the time frame that you're referring to, in terms of, like, you said that there was, you know, they were packed with media, there was a lot more attention, you know, paid on you, and you just felt like those opportunities weren't being capitalized on. What do you make of that?
I just think it was a general downsizing. I think that's what it was. You know, like, so when I first signed with the UFC, there was a UK office and a dedicated PR team. And there was a whole machine in the UK working, and we were doing regular events. You know, we were pretty much the second, you know, the second home for the UFC over in the UK. And we had a good, you know, a good pool of talent, but we had a lot of media attention. Like, I was doing like catalog shoots for UFC things in like general UK catalogs. I was speaking to tabloid newspapers, and I was writing for, you know, fitness magazines and stuff like, and all, we were all doing it. You know, it wasn't just me, it was all the UK guys. There was a lot of attention on us because we had a good PR team behind us. But then obviously, you know, with the sale of the UFC and everything became downsized, you know, the head of the UK office was gotten rid of, and that job was passed to someone that worked in Vegas, which obviously there's a disconnect there. So then the highest ranking people in the UK are not actually heads of the region. They're people that work at head of PR or whatever else. And, you know, the UK office was closed, and that then everything broke into two, and security and logistics went one way, and like social media and PR went into the IMG offices. And I don't know. I mean, there just seems to be a lot of, maybe there's like tension or politics going on in the office or something, but it just seemed like such a kind of, I don't know, not a lot got done. And it was frustrating because I was used to hearing from people regularly saying, hey, you're speaking to this person this week, or, you know, can you come to this racetrack and do this shoot with such and such? There was a steady flow of stuff. And me being an ambassador, you know, I had a monthly retainer that kept me around to be doing those kind of things. And especially since the Herb Dean thing, but even before that, you know, from the sale of the UFC to to IMG, it just seemed to drop off, like effort and attention towards the fighters and promotion. And
it's an odd feeling, loving something so much and feeling like it doesn't love you back. That's the way it's felt to me when the UFC has been withholding or denying or non-communicative. Does it strike you the same way?
Yeah, it's horrible because, you know, I love the UFC as a fan, and I love mixed martial arts as a lifelong martial artist. And it's like all of a sudden it's corporation, and it's tainted everything that I love with greed, you know. And it's all about, like, okay, I mean, here's a good example, right? Because, but like, I consider that I fought towards the end of the golden age of mixed martial arts. You know, like, for me, the golden age was those like early, like UFC 30s, you know, the early BJ Penns, Jens Pulver, all the way through the Ultimate Fighter. And then, you know, just when we started to break into the UK, into Europe. And for me, like a big part of it was the distinctive personalities, the backgrounds, the stories of the fighters. Like, everyone seemed like clones of one another now. You know, as soon, like at one point it was a free market. I had Earache Records sponsoring me. I had a bunch of smaller companies that had a bit of a marketing budget that could get behind their favorite fighter. And then that sponsorship tax came in. And then everyone had to pay, what was it, $50,000 or $100,000 to just sponsor a UFC fighter.
Right.
Which meant that then there was a pool of maybe 10 sponsors left that had a considerably reduced marketing budget that was then spread out through the roster. And everyone kind of got watered down a bit and everyone lost a bit of cash, you know? And then there was the next stage where the banners went, and it was just this constantly squeezing the life out of it. And that's the bit that hurts so much, is because like these guys coming up now, the idea now is, well, how do I protect myself and play the game and make the most money? And you know, you look back at the old Nick Diaz, Robbie Lawler kind of days, like they were there for the love of it, for the honor of it, for the privilege of standing in front of a crowd and showing what you're capable of. And I don't know, I feel like it's moving away from that a bit now. And to feel like, you know, to certainly feel like I'm actually pushed away from the UFC feels really odd. It's really odd because it's something that's been such a part of my life for so long.
It's a different world. that's the best way I can say it. We're like a relic of the past. It's like, we have to sacrifice these things for the benefit of the future. Are we really benefiting though? Are we really forwarding it? Is the sport really at a different level? Or is this just a cash grab? Like the thing that I think about is like, when I hear fighters saying, I'm ranked number 9, this guy's ranked number 3. If I beat this guy, he's campaigning based on rankings. And you know, given what we've seen over the last couple of years, the way they match make some fights, I don't know how you can look at yourself in the mirror, honestly, and say, if I do X, Y, and Z, this will all go in a linear fashion according to plan. It just changed so much. Do you think about that at all in terms of the way that, you know, like you said, you know, fighters being clones and stuff like that. I think of like looking at the younger generation coming up, seeing where we are now and kind of like how they're talking and being like, you know, the road has gotten a lot harder in so many ways. That's not really a question. Yeah. I mean, it's me. You share your thoughts. I'll stop talking.
No, I do agree. I do agree. You know, I think that I don't know. I just think that there was a point where the fighters were celebrated and looked after and cared for and respected in a way that I just don't think they are as much anymore. You know, and you know, of course, the sport's grown in the numbers of the fights on the roster, etc. But I think there are still fighters out there that they want to fight in front of a crowd that shout their name and they want to show their skills. They're not interested in chasing a belt. But like the idea of not being in the rankings if you're on the UFC roster is not an option. Like you've always got to be chasing towards the belt. And if it gets to the stage where you're losing to, you know, I mean, like Cowboy got his ass kicked this weekend. And like, look at Diego before he got the disqualification, getting his ass kicked against Pereira. Like, they're not matchups that need to happen. Like, we don't need to see those. And it's people say the word promotion, but they don't really examine the word promotion. And that's the thing that's become more apparent to me over the years. And I had an up and down relationship with the UFC because when I first signed the UFC, I thought we were one family within mixed martial arts and we're all walking towards the same thing. And those speeches that Dana used to give after the weigh-ins, like even you'd be walking out of the room with your arm around your opponent, going, "Come on, dude, let's give a great show tomorrow for the fans." Like that's how it made you feel. But then, like as soon as I fought GSP, I realized that I'd been kind of hustled along because there was a lack of contenders. I got that flight. For looking back now, it's embarrassing what I was paid for that fight, what I gave, or what it cost me to fight. You know what I mean? But then I look at my run after that, and they go, okay, co-main event against Carlos Condit, it was a win-win for them, because if I won, I'd won in front of my home crowd, and if he won, he was the next name to put in front of GSP as a new contender. Then I come off my first knockout loss, and they put me against Anthony Johnson. And it was like, I just kind of felt like all of a sudden I was now being cycled out. Do you know what I mean? And I'm going to fight anybody and everybody. I see that more and more now. I see it, you know, I see guys, well, this guy's got a name. So we'll either use him against a young fighter and build that person up. Like, let's bring Ken Shamrock out of retirement and have him fight Rich Franklin, because no one knows who Franklin is, even though he's one of the highest ranked middleweights in the world. And we need a contender. It's that kind of feeling. And I wish there was some kind of care for fighters like Cowboy and like Jim Miller and Clay Guida and Diego Sanchez. Like, they still want to fight. We still can celebrate them on the top stage of the sport. And they don't need to be in this shark tank with all these young guys trying to keep their head above water. But they're a commodity that's being used to promote the younger generations of fighters. And it puts everyone in a weird situation where no one really wants to be doing that. Like, the young guys coming through beating these former legends they used to look up to, it doesn't feel good for either party. And you know, that's something else that I feel could be, you know, it could be better dealt with, I think. It would be a better look for the sport as well.
Sure. Were you calling out, like, Matt Brown and I can't remember the other guy that you called out. Were you calling them out before this drama happened with Herb, or after? Herb and the PR team. Like, were the call outs a function of, like, you sensing there was a change and wanting to move in a different direction, or was that just a natural thing that came up? You calling out Matt Brown and wanting to restart your fight career. I mean, you've always kind of wanted to. You've said it several times over the years, but it seems like there was a little bit of a shift there, and I was hoping you could put that into context for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I'd had conversations with Sean and with Mick, and I'd said, look, you know, these are the guys I'd like to fight, you know, and I'd listed the names off. I mean, you know, a Diaz, I don't mind which, they're largely the same person anyway. Matt Brown, because that's who I was originally matched with when I was pulled out from the fight back in 2013. Carlos Condit, because I own one back. You know, like, they were the names that I gave them, and these are names I've been talking about for a while. And I had a couple put back in my direction a few years ago. Like, I had Joe Lozon suggested to me, which I just have no interest in fighting. And same with Jim Miller. You know, I've got to, if I'm only having one or two fights, I want to fight the guy. You know, and there's a lot of guys on the roster. I literally just don't want to punch Joe Lozano in the face. It's as simple as that. And as a fighter, as a contractor, I should have some choice in that, I feel. Especially at this point in my career where you know for sure I'm not contending for a belt. And I've said that all the way through. I don't want to be fighting these, you know, I don't want to be fighting people that are still in the mix, because I respect the mix enough to know that I'm not in it. You know, but I also, you know, like, either let me fight someone else that's not in the mix, or let me go with the circumstance. And literally up until last week, I was under contract as a fighter. And I mean, I even spoke to Dana a couple of times about it, and he just kind of laughed at me. Like, why? These are actually his words. Why would you want to do that? You've got a job for life. So then, like, you know, when I'm being sent home from Fight Island, I'm fired up and I'm angry because I've not been heard. And I've been, you know, the whole circumstance has been misunderstood. I'm like, right, okay, well, let's put me back in my natural habitat then. You know, if I'm not natural in this habitat, let me go back into my natural habitat. I called out Matt Brown. He accepted the fight. He wanted the fight. I spoke to the UFC directly. I sent Sean Shelby a direct message, and I said, I want Matt Brown, Carlos Condit, and then I want Nick Diaz. They're the three that I'm looking at. And he messaged me back. He said, I'll get back with you next week. And I never heard from him again. And, you know, and then, like, a few days after that, all of a sudden Matt Brown's matched on the most distant card in the future, that's not got any other matchups on it yet. It was like July. They put him on a card in July. They've not got it. It was just weird. It was like you're just kind of sticking a middle finger up at me now, you know? So it was like I immediately knew they weren't going to match me. And if they were going to match me, they were just going to, you know, it was going to be a fight that just wasn't at all appealing to me and wasn't beneficial to me at this stage in my career.
So this is after the Herb Dean thing, but before the PR thing, somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I'd had conversations a few times. They were keen on me announcing my comeback at UFC London, the one that was cancelled.
Oh.
So that was a conversation that had been had as well between myself and a couple of the UFC execs.
Did you say that already, or is this breaking news right here? I don't remember hearing.
I've not said that before because it never got anywhere. You know, it was a conversation that. I mean, where was I? I was in Uruguay late the year before that, and they were like, "Well, you know, we could break it here in Uruguay. Why are you here on the desk?" And I'm like Uruguay on a fight night, like it just doesn't make any sense.
Hey, what do you got against Uruguay? Uruguay is as good of a place as what's the beef with Uruguay?
Because I remember when Bisping got put in the Hall of Fame in London and the crowd went up and the idea of announcing that at London was, you know.
Fair enough. So you were going to be, they were going to announce it at that fight card or was it that far along? Did you have an opponent or they were just like, he's coming back?
No. They were going to announce that I was going to fight again. That was the plan. Because I think there was obviously, the London card, it was Leon and Woodley.
Yeah.
Obviously, they were planning on doing another card later in the year, September time, which was what I was aiming for. I mean, that's what I was keeping in mind, which is what I said to the UFC when I contacted them this time, like late summer is when I'm looking. Because I want to make sure I've been training, but I want to make sure I lay a good foundation before I go back in there and, you know, let someone try and kill me.
wise move. So the time, like, you know, again, the time between the request via the interview and your release letter comes, you don't even finish the letter. What's going through your mind? Are you like, yippee? Like, are you texting, you know, Bellator? Are you just saying to your manager, cast the net out? Are you going into grieving? A combination of the three.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really think it's quite sunk in yet, and it still feels kind of weird. I mean, you know, because I always thought that, you know, whenever I visualize myself fighting again, apart from daydreaming of fighting in Pride back in the day, my visualizations of fighting was always in the UFC, in the octagon. You know, it's like second home to me now. I spend a good 20 minutes in there before every commentary gig. And, you know, just kind of walking around and feeling the canvas and stuff. It's you know, it's a very comfortable place for me now. So the idea of fighting somewhere else, it seems like a bit surreal at the moment. But, you know, the more Rising and One and Bellator and stuff I watch, I mean, we'll see what happens. I know that people are aware and have been in contact, but at the moment I'm not really thinking about it too much. And until someone comes to me and says, what about this date and this person? Then, you know, I'll kind of stay out of it and let my manager deal with it.
But the opponent seems really important to you.
Yeah, because I've got it's my last training camp, my last two, three training camps ever. Like, I want to fight. I want to be up for it. I want a challenge, you know. And I'm not even necessarily saying it'd be MMA. I mean, I would box. I would kickbox. You know, my options are open. You know, I've never boxed professionally, but I'd be open to it. But, you know, kickboxing Muay Thai professionally, you know, that was what I was doing before MMA. But then, you know, I quite like the One and Rising rule sets. You know, downward elbows and knees to the head on the ground. I know it might seem a bit heavy for some, but, you know, I am the outlaw and I do kind of fit in those environments where you're strapping. So I don't know. I mean, you know, I guess it's not really sunk in yet. I've been doing bag work with One gloves and with Rising gloves on just to kind of feel them out. And I've got a red set and a blue set of Bellator gloves as well. So I'm kind of, you know, the idea of it, you know, is, you know, but I'm also doing a lot of bare knuckle stuff and boxing glove stuff. So got to keep my options open, eh?
You're auditioning via equipment.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go, exactly.
Well, I mean, is there anybody that you want to fight that's out there that's a name that you respect and that is in one of these promotions?
You know, I mean, I've been so focused on those three names in particular. And I mean, Condit, Brown, and Diaz were the perfect three. And, you know, if you want to throw Cowboy in there as well, even though maybe not after his last couple of fights, you know, like, I feel the same. I'm just kind of, you know. And it's the same with Diego. You know, Matt Diego's a free agent, but would I want to fight the guy? No, I want to give him a hug and try and help him in the circumstance that he's in, because it seemed like a shitty one.
I can assure you.
It seems pretty rough. But like, you know, like if I'm daydreaming, like I could see me fighting someone like Gomi and Pride in Rising. You know, that would be a lot of fun. I know Aoki's moving around in weight classes in one, but I don't think I'd be able to get down to 170 to be walking around 5 week. If I was fighting in one, I'd be coming in at 185, which I know is welterweight, but I'm 210 at the moment, so that gives you an idea of you know where my weight's at and what I'm looking at. I need a bit of time to get myself back into fight shape. I'm into deadlifting cars at the moment.
Yeah, I mean. If you watch Tyson's interview, he talks about getting back into fight shape, not just, you know, good shape, but fight shape, and how much of a shock to the system it is.
Yeah.
Do you anticipate that kind of barrier to overcome?
I absolutely think so. I mean, the good thing is I kind of trained myself, you know, I've got a few Pavlovian responses from back in the day to certain songs and music that I can use to get my brain switched back on. But I've also got a lot of frustration, which helps. You know, a lot of frustration from the last, you know, the last sort of 12 months or so. You know, and you know, for as awesome as Fight Island was, the experiences of being out there, like every single one of them was more stressful than the last. You know, they were really intense environments for whatever reason. It was just crammed in and shit up your nostril every day and weird sleep patterns and, you know, clubs on the other side of the harbor. And it was just, you know, so I feel like it'd be quite cathartic to get into a training camp at this point. I just need something to get my teeth into. I need a date to aim for, and I can't daydream a date up in my head. I need to go, right, there's an event on that day. That's what I'm aiming for, and I'll start working towards it. But the Airdyne's just been delivered today. I've got a new punch bag hanging up in the gym. We're moving in the right direction, but I'll take my time until I feel like the time's right to start putting my foot on the gas.
And just to clarify, do you need to clear your current medical situation with any of the commissions via a specific meeting, or have you talked to anybody about getting cleared in the past? Where do you stand with the regulatory side of things?
There are only a couple of commissions that would require me to have an ECG, and obviously, you know, with the fact that I was pulled out of a fight, my results were never submitted to the California Athletic Commission. They never made it out of Vegas. Like, I don't really know where I stand. I think it's literally California and Florida, the only two that I would be required to pass an ECG test. So there'll be other people on the roster that would have similar problems if they were, I mean, funnily enough, I've had a few fighters reach out that are experiencing some of those problems. When I came back to the UK, because when I was in Vegas, I was having the tests for the fight in California against Matt Brown. When the first lot of results came back and they said that they wouldn't be able to clear me to fight and I had to come back for more tests, I spoke to my doctor in the UK, the guy that's known me since I was a kid, and he said, don't do anything. Don't have any surgeries, any treatments or anything, and come back here and get tested. Because, you know, the healthcare systems in both countries are very different, and one's much more money orientated. And I did feel like it was a bit of a kind of came out of nowhere, you know, assessment, given the fact that I've been so healthy all the way through my life and my heart's never never been an issue. I've always been asymptomatic, even if I do have all Parkinson's white pattern. So anyway, long story. So I spoke to my doctor. He said not to do anything. The UFC wouldn't clear me, and I kind of was stuck in limbo for a few months. And then they got me into commentary. And while I was back in the UK, I went to see a cardiac specialist, a guy that runs a sports cardiology clinic. And I took all my test results from Vegas. He put me through the same tests, and he found no evidence of any problem. So like I have all of those more recent tests with all of the clear evidence that I'm absolutely fine and perfect to compete. So even if it came to a circumstance where I was put on a card in California, they required me to have an ECG, and so an anomaly showed up, I have a cardiac specialist that can explain what they're reading on the ECG tests. You've got to think, medicine's such a broad field. The guy that was looking at my results was not an expert on the electrical pathways of the heart. He was just kind of reading what he was, interpreting. But the specialist that I've been to see said there's absolutely no problem at all, and I have the paperwork that's cleared me.
Yeah, when it comes to doctors and getting cleared, your mileage may vary, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the other thing as well. I turned 39 in a couple of days, but I've only ever had 5 stitches in my whole life. I've been cut once. I've never had any major broken bones. I've been knocked out twice in my professional career, and maybe a couple of times in the gym. But I do not have mileage. Especially when I look at someone like Cowboy or Sanchez, and I'm like, literally, they look like they've been ran over by a truck and put back together with glue. I feel so fortunate that I'm not in that circumstance. Aches and pains and those kind of things, of course, but getting old now, and I've run up a few hills with a few logs on my back, so I deserve a few of those aches, But I'm relatively young for my age, and I do recognize that.
Is there a chance that your future might not include fighting? That somebody might offer you a commentary job, and you might continue to do what you do? Basically, what I'm getting at is, why go punch people and be punched in the head at 39?
Well, partly because I kind of feel like my career was never finished. I never showed the full expression of my skills. I was always kind of, I was working through various different cycles, and the point at which I was pulled out kind of felt like the beginning of, I kind of felt like the point where I was pulled out in the Matt Brown fight was kind of the beginning of the next cycle. Like, if I go back and watch the Amir Sadala fight, like the Dwayne Ludwig was saving my skin and keeping me on the roster. The Amir Sadala fight was, okay, I need 3 takedowns in this fight, and I need to not struggle with the nerves of fighting in my hometown. They were the main things to get over that. Matt Brown in California, I was going to light him up. I was going to make it a real bloody mess and stop him. And that was the beginning of the next stage of my final run, which was in my head already. So I don't feel like I've got loads more fights in me. I don't want to be fighting into my 50s. But I feel like I've got 2 or 3 fights against someone of a similar standing to me in the sport, where I could show the person that I am, the martial artist that I really am. You've got to think. I've watched hundreds and thousands of fights over the last 8 years. I have absorbed so much, and my understanding of mixed martial arts has increased so much. It kind of burns me a little bit that the last memory of me is that performance against Amir Sadala, which was I feel embarrassed by most of my fights, if I'm honest, because of how poor they were. I was ragged. I made bad decisions, and I'd just like to show that final expression of myself before, I'm perhaps too old.
Got it. Well, I don't know. Me personally, my memory of you changed. It's not of the fighter. It's of the guy who's a great commentator. And that's a good thing in and of itself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm not a commentator at the moment. I'm a contractor that occasionally steps into a commentary booth from time to time. I'll be probably working the Cage Warriors event coming up in June, but that's because I love Cage Warriors, not because I consider that to be a part of my job. I just want to be there and love Cage Warriors. But the reality is, if one of the organizations approached me and was like, hey, come and step onto our commentary team, I'd love to, because I love being, you know, cage side for, or cage ringside, whatever, for, you know, live electric professional fights. I mean, it's, you know, it's an absolute buzz. But you know, I'm open to all kinds of things. I'm working on my next book at the moment, and that's taking up a lot of brain power, as well as running the full Reptile channel, which, you know, it keeps me stuck in research about half the week.
Yeah, man. you're on the media grind now. How does it feel? Not fun, yeah. Right?
You know, yeah. I mean, it's up and down. But I've got a great team around me, and I'm just fortunate. I mean, I'm able to, you know, to do what I do. You know, I sit in my house and watch fights and break them down and train fighters and run my gym. I'm in a very, very fortunate position. I don't even miss what I had with the UFC. The only thing I don't like about the circumstance is the weird tension and friction between the two of us, because I just don't feel it's necessary, and I feel like it's based on lies on that end, you know?
Yeah. Well, go easy on that Wad guy. Speaking of old guys, he's pretty old. So go easy on him.